We're doing overviews, continuing to do overviews this week and next week. And I know some legislators think overviews are boring, but I think it's important we get kind of a grounding in the issues before we start making policy. And we're waiting for people to author their bills and introduce them so that we can have those in front of the committee. So today we're going to start with a presentation from Otter Tail Power and Lauren Law.
First G is silent, Lawtog.
Lawtog is here from Otter Tail Power. If you could identify yourself for the tape and go ahead.
Yep, thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Lauren Lawtog with Otter Tail Power Company in Fergus Falls, Minnesota. Otter Tail Power Company, you should have a copy of this presentation in your folders if you want to follow along. We serve about 70,000 square miles in northwestern Minnesota, in the eastern half of North Dakota, and the northeast part of South Dakota. We employ about 785 people, and among those, 495 are in Minnesota. And actually about more than half of our employees are members of the International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers. On this map, you can see a general idea of where our generating stations are in western North Dakota. It's called Coyote Station, coal plant, burns lignite coal. In South Dakota, the Big Stone plant also burns coal. And in Fergus Falls, our oldest and smallest unit is Hoot Lakes plant. Our wind farms are in North Dakota. They're identified on your map as the Laverne Wind Farm, the Ashtabula Wind Energy Center, and the Langdon Wind Energy Center, and we own all of these. We serve only 129,000 customers, and just over 60,000 of these are in North Dakota, and that's just about 4% of all of the electric customers in Minnesota. Those customers are scattered in Minnesota through 153 towns, and we also serve about 1,427 farms. In the three states together, we serve a total of 423 communities. The three largest are Jamestown, North Dakota, Fergus Falls, and Babiji, Minnesota. Just to give you a flavor for the scale of the towns that we serve, of the 153 towns we serve in Minnesota, if you rank them from top to bottom, largest to smallest, the median-sized town has only 220 people. So I went through that list and I grabbed town number 77, and it turns out that that's Winger, Minnesota, which is up just south of Erskine, where former Majority Leader Roger Moe lives. With 220 residents, it has a median annual household income of just $21,000 a year. The businesses in Winger are the Farmers Co-op Elevator, Moran's Family Restaurant, and the Depot Cafe and Convenience Store, which has a gas station. So you've all been to these towns around Minnesota, and you've driven by them or through them, probably. More than 20% of the households in Winger have someone who is over 65 and lives alone. Now, why do I bring out Winger for the members of the committee? I think it's important for people to realize that not all utility companies are the same, and not all utility companies serve the same kinds of customers. When you're considering legislation in the committee, and you're thinking about raising this by 5% or raising that by 10%, I think it's important to think about the impact it might have. Think about half the towns we have are smaller than Winger, Minnesota. And in these towns, they're living on the edge. And people don't make a lot of money. And no one pays the bills for mandates except for the customers. So any mandates that we agree to with the legislature eventually get paid for by people in places like Winger. So not the same as Woodbury or Plymouth or Edina. Our average residential rate is about 8.2 cents and that's actually in the lower among investor-owned utilities, which we are one. Among investor-owned utilities and co-ops, we are in the lower quartile, and perhaps we may be second lowest behind Minnesota Power, but I'm not positive about that. Our generation portfolio has about 800 megawatts of owned capacity, and we peak in the wintertime. So this is probably our peak week, yesterday or today. Everybody comes in on Monday morning, except yesterday was a holiday for some folks, so some people didn't go to their place of work, but by today, it was 18 below in Fergus Falls, and throughout our system, there were places where it was 22 or 25 below, and wind chills were not as much today, high as they were yesterday, but we peak in the wintertime, and so we have to have generation to meet that peak requirement. These two pie graphs that you see, if you can think of the left one, it says capacity, and the right one says energy. The left one you can think of as a speedometer on a car. That shows at the maximum speed you go, this is where it all comes from. 65% comes from coal, and 21% comes from wind. Lesser amounts from oil, gas, and hydro. The circle on the right is that's the odometer. So over the course of a year, how far did you drive? We drove this far. The kilowatt hours that were generated come from these places. You can see the coal portion is much larger because it's what we call capacity factor is much higher. It runs all the time. Now, the graph on the right, I'll note too, also excludes 21% of all the power that we transact because we buy that on the open market. And the chair asked us to go through some considerations regarding renewable energy, environmental performance, customer satisfaction. And our customer satisfaction ratings, which are done by the American Customer Satisfaction Index, Otter Tail consistently ranks in the top five nationally for customer satisfaction. And ACSI ranks actually 75% of all the utilities that serve, or companies that serve 75% of the residential customers in the United States. On the renewable energy front, renewable energy consists of about 15% of our total retail sales. That's somewhere in the top five in the nation as well. And what's happened is the existence of the federal production tax credit, which was just renewed as a part of the fiscal cliff resolution, has allowed our company to provide wind energy to our customers on a least cost resource basis. This is very important for us because we have to get our rates approved in Bismarck and Pierre. And when we go there, the only basis for including anything in rates is that you did what was least cost. So we're able to spread that cost throughout our three states. We're not required to generate 25 by 25 in the Dakotas. In the Dakotas, it's 10% by 25. But we're still able to generate wind at about 15% of all of the sales we have in all three states. The addition of wind energy has also reduced our company's what we call CO2 per megawatt hour, that we generation intensity, by 18% since 2007. So for every kilowatt hour we sell, there's less CO2 attached because of wind. In the 1940s, Otter Tail started controlling electric water heaters to control our load on days like this, and we still do that, and a lot of other things as well. And when we passed in 2007 new standards for energy efficiency, beginning in 2009, Otter Tail has been able to consistently manage between 1 and 1.5% of our retail sales for energy efficiency. And the consultant who did our, we call a demand-side management potential study, a Navigant consultant, described us as what they thought was a best practice utility with respect to conservation and energy efficiency programs. And the last slide I'll show you is something we did on the energy efficiency front. For our 100-year anniversary in 2009, we picked one of our small towns, and we picked a small college campus, the University of Minnesota Crookston, and we offered them what we call Energy Challenge. And the goal was to save 15% energy in each of these two locations, the town of Rothsay and the campus at Crookston. And we engaged the students in that process in both Rothsay, Minnesota, and in Crookston, and they made recommendations. In Rothsay, we were able to save, over 5 years, we're projecting 19% savings, and in Crookston, we're projecting 17% savings. So the students were very helpful in rising up to the challenge of this project. Madam Chair, those are all the prepared comments I have, and if anyone has questions, I'd be happy to answer them.
Questions? Representative Hornstein.
Thank you very much for your presentation. It's helpful to me. I'm not in your zone there, so it's good to hear it. Sort of the energy challenge slide, I think those are great numbers, and 19 and 17% respectively. Do you think that points to the fact that maybe our 1.5% efficiency standard might be a little low? It seems like we can do a little better. That's what these college kids were indicating to us.
Okay. Madam Chair, Representative Hornstein, I need to make one clarification. The 19% is a cumulative number.
Okay.
And the same with the 17% at the University of Minnesota Crookston. We're 3 years into this now, and at the pace we're on, we will finish at 19% in Rothsay and at 17%.
And so, thank you.
Representative Hornstein.
And again, this is great. I'm supportive. But I, in terms of the when you get to those figures, how many years will it take? Because you said it's a.
Mr. Lockhart.
Representative Hornstein, that's a 5-year projection,
okay,
based on today. And of course, your goal is sustained savings, so the annual number should continue for many years into the future as well.
So. Well, I'm sure I think this is an example of why efficiency can really be a really important part of our overall agenda. And then I have one other quick question.
Representative Hornstein.
On the slide rates and generation, can you explain, I'm new to the committee, so I apologize to others if this is clearer to you, but can you explain the difference between the nameplate and net dependable capacity on the left and then the energy slide on the right? I'm especially interested in understanding more the disparity between on the left pie, the 65.3% coal, and then the 79.2% coal on the right.
Mr. Lachlan.
Madam Chair, Representative Hornstein. Again, the left graph is your speedometer that says this car can drive 120 miles per hour. And when our car, speaking metaphorically, is driving at full capacity, this is where it's coming from. Based on nameplate capacity for coal is, let's just say it's a 500 megawatt coal plant. If it has an 88 or a 90% capacity rating for over the year, it delivers, let's say, 90% of what it could deliver for 24/7 every day of the year, then that would get you the number you see over on the right side, your sort of odometer reading. Wind, on the other hand, would have a nameplate capacity. Typically, one turbine has 1.5 megawatts. And so its nameplate is high. But its capacity factor, in most places, it's only between 30 and 35%. But we've been actually able to get, in North Dakota, we've gotten capacity numbers in the 42 to 45% range. So it produces 1.5 megawatts on the left graph. But over on the right side, it would be less than that. It would be typically, let's say, 44% of that. So there's a difference.
Thank you.
Representative Morgan.
Thank you, Madam Chair. If Mr. Lochtuck, you have a little bit here about the renewable energy and your how you've been able to reduce your carbon footprint. Could you talk a little bit about how you are moving along towards the goal, and also what impact that has had on the cost to your customers, the renewable energy standard from OSEV?
Mr. Lochtuck.
Madam Chair and Representative Morgan, With respect to the goal, I'm assuming you're talking about where are we on the trajectory to, I think it's 2050, to reduce by 80%? I'm not sure I have the right here.
Representative Morgan, did you mean the renewable energy standard
yes.
or the greenhouse gas emissions goal?
Thank you, Madam Chair. The renewable energy standard, Mr. Lott.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair. The goal is 25 by 25, and we're at 15%, not just for Minnesota, but for all three states that we serve. So if we allocated all of that just to Minnesota, we would be at 25 or more right now. But we're doing it for our entire system. And with respect to the cost question, again, since we have had the production tax credit, we have done accelerated construction of wind projects, as many other utilities have done. The PTC has disappeared more than once in the past, and so a prudent person would make best use of it while it's available, and so we've been able to add it as a least cost resource, so we can say it has not cost our customers anything extra to this point. Without the production tax credit, however, that would change.
Representative Morgan.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Mr. Lottak, just a follow-up for me. The production tax credit, the federal incentive, then does that provide a stream of income for the wind project for 20 years after you take advantage of it?
Madam Chair, the PTC is good for 10 years.
10.
And it's performance-based, so you get about 2.2 cents for every kilowatt hour you generate.
So the benefit for the project that you build this year will last 10 years?
Yeah, that's correct.
Representative Quam.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm not seeing, I'd like to understand, you've got getting great efficiency or productivity out of your wind. What portion of that is peak hour versus non-peak?
Mr. Lottog.
Madam Chair, Representative Quam, if you overlay the chart for peak production and peak consumption, they don't necessarily match up. In fact, sometimes the wind produces the most during the night when you don't really need power. So point is well taken. However, we are a winter peaking utility, and because of that, we have heating requirements at night, and it matches up probably better with a winter peaking utility than it might a summer peaking utility.
Representative Quam.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I was looking for numbers, you know, especially if you have to purchase power outside the system during certain times. I'd like to understand, because that helps me understand the baseline requirements that we need for power. And so if at a later time you can provide the chairwoman, maybe we can, you know, have as committee members the actual data and numbers, so we can better understand this. Thank you.
Mr. Lottog, anything you want to pass along to the committee? We'll distribute to all
Chair,
the members.
Yes. I might add to that, Representative Plum, that we bid our wind, like every other generation source, into the MISO pool in one day ahead. And so we use wind forecasts. And if wind forecasts are high, then we would probably purchase less other kinds of power. And we do purchase power in the open market from day to day. So There's an opportunity to balance that to some degree. However, as you've probably heard, it can be difficult if you've got contracts that are longer term, and then the wind blows at very high rates when you don't need that much. Let's say in the spring or the fall, and the challenge we've had sometimes is getting it delivered to places where you could actually sell it to. And if you can't move it to someplace you can sell it to, you actually take you have to pay to deliver it. So in those circumstances, you can get hurt. But we've not gone that far in overbuilding, so we've been in pretty good shape in that regard. But I'll see if I can find some quantitative information for you.
Thank you, Mr. Lottog. We need to move on to our next testifier because we're going to be adjourning at 1:30 today for caucuses on the budget. Do you want to ask Mr. Lottog?
If I can.
Sure. Well, Representative Garofalo asks his question if Bill Black can come down from MMUA.
Thank you for your testimony before the committee today. So you, in your documents you listed, you got just over 60,000 customers. What would you say your customers' tolerance is for policies that would raise their rates? I mean, how much can they absorb describe for this committee?
As briefly as possible, Mr.
Madam Chair and Representative Garofalo, while I'm here, there might be some folks who think I represent the shareholders of my company, but I always see myself as representing customers first. And again, my standard, preferred standard, would be that we do things that are cost-effective and least cost for customers. The efficiency programs I described have been very much like that, and we've been able to do renewable wind like that as well. So we've been happy with it so far.
Thank you, Mr. Lautog, and thank you for being willing to serve as a resource to the committee as we get up to speed. Mr. Black.
This is Bill Black. I'm with the Minnesota Municipal Utilities Association. Madam Chair, members, thank you for having me. I've got several slides that I can run through. I don't have printouts, but I tried to use large type. I don't have an engineering background like Mr. Lautog, but I do have a Mr. Larry Johnston from Southern Minnesota Municipal Power Agency, who's here today, too, who could help out with more technical questions or questions that have more to do with wholesale power generally in the municipal sector. But I'm going to go through the basics of the municipal electric utility sector for the state of Minnesota. There are 125 municipal electric and 31 municipal gas utilities in the state. 17 cities have both. And of the 87 county seats in Minnesota, 50 of them are served by municipal electric or gas utility. This presentation focuses mainly on the electrics. Here in Minnesota, municipal utilities tend to be more of a small-town institution. The largest here by far is Rochester. In fact, Rochester Public Utilities is almost three times the size of the next largest municipal electric, which is Moorhead. Almost three-quarters of our municipal utilities, 90 of them, have fewer than 2,500 customers. 40%, that's 48 utilities, have fewer than 1,000 customers. And these are the smallest municipal utilities in Minnesota. You'll see that Wayland has only 42 customers. We're really talking about a different style of utility than a large metropolitan. And in fact, I ran the numbers here, and on the House Energy Committee here, seven municipal utilities and four agencies are represented by four of the members of the committee. In the Senate, we have actually 33 municipals represented, but just an interesting difference. The average municipal utility is about one-eighth the size of the average co-op in Minnesota. And if you look at the median-sized municipals, are about one-fifth as large. Even though there are 170 utilities in the state, and 125 of them are municipal, the proportion of the state's retail energy that they provide is actually only 14%. Nationally, about 15% of electricity comes from publicly owned utilities, so Minnesota is very typical. You'll sometimes hear public power or publicly owned used interchangeably with municipal utility. It's the same thing, except that some ownership is public, but not strictly speaking municipal. In some states, there's ownership by groups of cities together or regional-type public ownership arrangements. Municipal power agencies in Minnesota are also public power. And I'll talk about more about the agencies in a minute. 58% of the power sold by our municipal utilities comes from these municipal power agencies. You'll see that on this slide, we buy electricity to resell from investor-owned utilities at 16%. 13% of our power comes from cooperative utilities. And WAPA stands for Western Area Power Administration. That's federal hydropower. The municipal power agencies, with their logos shown here, are the public power partners of Minnesota's municipal utilities. Each not-for-profit agency is a membership organization, with the members being municipal utilities. Their boards are made up of representatives from the utilities themselves. MMPA, that's Minnesota Municipal Power Agency, membership is mostly near the Twin Cities area, but also includes East Grand Forks. Southern, or SIMPA, is made up of these member communities. Not all are in the South, as the name implies, but that's the way the agency has grown since it started in 1977. Northern Minnesota Power members are in the Northwest. And Heartland is called a consumer powers district because it's organized that way under South Dakota law. And it's headquartered just across the border, serving communities in South Dakota and Minnesota. But it's also basically what we would call a municipal power agency here. And Missouri River Energy Services serves communities in western Minnesota as well as Iowa and north and South Dakota. Here again is the chart showing where our power comes from. In the background, you can see the Faribault Energy Center owned by Minnesota Municipal Power Agency, or MMPA from the previous slide. It's a power plant, as a combined cycle gas turbine that produces 300 megawatts of electricity for the agency's member communities. That is the newest large plant owned by a municipal power agency serving Minnesota. The blue slice of the pie, as I mentioned, is Federal Hydropower, WAPA. And the federal hydropower that comes from a series of federal hydropower dams on the Missouri River is the energy I'm speaking of. Nearly all the federal hydropower allotments for the municipal utilities that possess them date back to the 1950s and 60s. This hydropower is not considered renewable under Minnesota's renewable energy standard. Only hydropower from much smaller dams may be counted toward the renewable energy standard. As you can tell here, eligibility for WAPA power allocation was based in part on geographical distance from the Missouri River. All the power agencies serving Minnesota municipals have at least one member that receives federal hydropower. Virtually all of Missouri River Energy Services members in Minnesota have a federal hydropower allocation, as well as six utilities that are not affiliated with any power agency. The municipal electric sector met the good faith effort objective of 7% renewable by the end of 2010, as well as the first mandatory standard of 12% by the end of 2020. This is one of the large wind farms that supply power to municipal utility communities. SMPA buys all the energy from the 67 turbines at this location, the Wapsinipicone wind farm south of Rochester. NMPA receives its wind power from Ashtabula Wind Farm west of Fargo through Minn Kota Cooperative, and Missouri River Energy buys 40 megawatts from the Rugby Farm wind farm in north central North Dakota and from turbines in Minnesota, 9 near Marshall, 10 near Odin, and 4 outside of Worthington. Some public power wind comes from small local generation sites. The ones in green here are Minnesota Municipal Power Agency's Hometown Wind Power Project. They each have a turbine in their area. There are 2 in Redwood Falls, 4 in Fairmont, owned by SMPA, 3 in Moorhead, and 4 in Worthington, owned by Missouri River, 1 in Mountain Lake, owned by Central Minnesota, and 2 in Wilmer, owned by Wilmer Municipal Utilities. Hydropower from plants with less than 100 megawatts qualifies as renewable energy under the RES. Naturally, municipals were early adopters of small hydro. Here's the municipal hydro plant at Granite Falls. The 4 electric generators in this photo all burn gas from landfill in Elk River. Other utilities have landfill gas plants too, and others generate power from municipal solid waste. Virginia and Hibbing Municipal Utilities partnered to create the Laurentian Energy Authority, which burns waste wood from lumber operations and will one day burn poplar trees from its own tree farm. There are new federal regulations for diesel generators that require these utilities to spend $40,000 to $100,000 each to capture more emissions. For some units, this will make economic sense. Others may be retired. It may seem like a good idea to retire some of these older generators, but they have been useful in short runs for emergency backup power, voltage support, and reliability insurance in communities that receive the bulk of their power from distant sources. And many of them also run biodiesel. I'll skip ahead to keep my time short. Despite what you often hear, municipal utilities are not unregulated. They are locally regulated. We talk here at the Capitol about the Public Utilities Commission as if there were only one. Of course, we mean the state PUC, but there are actually over 60 local public utility commissions in the state regulating municipal electric utilities. About half of the municipal utilities in Minnesota are governed by a local public utility commission. The other half are governed directly by their city councils. This picture commemorates a retiring Blooming Prairie Commissioner Ronald Anderson in the center of the photo. In many other respects, Minnesota's municipal utilities are governed under state statutes like investor-owned and cooperative utilities. Every utility in Minnesota is part of the state's conservation improvement program. Every power agency is subject to the renewable energy standard. We're governed by laws that require all utilities to assist low-income customers who can't pay their bills in the winter by permitting laws and statutes that define where we serve. Our councils and commissions are also subject to open meeting statutes and Government Data Practices Act. We're also obviously involved in the SIP program. MMUA helps quite a bit in developing homegrown talent for the municipal utility workforces. We have a training center in Marshall, Minnesota, where we often cooperate with cooperative utilities for training as well. Every year, line workers and supervisors from other municipal utilities come to the aid of communities hit by disaster. These are just a few of the larger disasters of the past few years where the Municipal Mutual Aid Network was called into action under the organization structure set up by MMUA. Generally, electric service is restored in municipal electric utility communities in surprisingly quick fashion. You know, I added Hurricane Sandy. We had, I think, 30 to 60 municipal electric utility line workers go to Long Island last year to aid in that recovery effort. We partner to help cities grow wisely. When you call your municipal utility, you get someone in your town answering the phone. The Public Power Week is recognized annually in the first week of October in municipal utilities communities across the state and nation. And more than 60 cities in Minnesota are served today by a municipal electric utility founded over 100 years ago. The oldest in the city of Ada was founded in 1876. And that ends my presentation, Madam Chair.
Questions from members on the committee? I have a question. Are your generation sources that serve your the municipal electric utilities very different from the investor-owned? I have to imagine that with the small size that they're serving, that a different kind of facility that generates electricity makes sense.
Madam Chair, we actually, the municipal utilities receive their power from at least 17 different sources, so it's all across the board. There are some who receive over 90% federal hydropower, and then there are others who receive none whatsoever. Everyone, you know, under a power agency receives the renewable energy standard, requirement of renewable energy, and so the sources, I would say, probably a little more reliant on the distant source. At one time, the municipal utilities were the primary sources of generation in the areas and actually served the outlying communities and provided power to cooperatives that served the rural areas. And we've shifted so much more now to a distant generation situation where we're reliant on the transmission system to bring the power from further sources. The local generation, we have 192 diesel generators in 48 communities that are being affected by the new federal emission standards. So that number may be decreasing drastically. But they're important sources for local generation when the transmission system isn't available or there's disaster problems. I could get more, I'll try to get more specific information for you if I can.
Which is interesting because I know we'll be talking about later in the session distributed generation, and it sounds like there are many people who like the idea of getting the generation sources closer to the customers, and it sounds like that's where your entities began, and then they shifted to being transmission dependent, and it'll be interesting if you swing back. Representative Beard.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Black it is, I believe?
Yes, sir.
I'm thinking of the one of the utilities that's in the area I represent, Shakopee Public Utilities. I think their members are of, is it SMPA? Southern Minnesota Public Power Association, if I'm not mistaken.
Madam Chair, Representative Beard, actually I believe that they're part of the Minnesota Municipal Power Agency.
Oh, they're there now. Okay. The question I have, Madam Chair, is this. When we're trying to comply with the renewable energy standard, is right. It up to each muni, Municipal Power Association, munis we call them, to find their own path to compliance, or can they do that through the association, the power purchasing association they belong to? Who's going to be responsible for accomplishing that goal, if you can refresh my memory?
Mr. Black.
Madam Chair, Representative Beard, the Renewable Energy Standard defines electric utility as an investor-owned utility or a transmission and generation cooperative or a municipal power agency. So the wholesale power entities, the municipal power agencies, the six that are member associations who provide the wholesale power to the local municipal electric utility are responsible for making sure that the designated percentage of that wholesale power is renewable.
Representative Beard.
A thing, and in follow-up, then, a compliance with the SIP mandate, then, does that fall on the Power Association as well, or is that the individual municipality?
Mr. Black.
Madam Chair, Representative Beard, that is different. That the SIP standard, the requirement to conserve 1.5% energy each year, is on the distribution utility, the 125 city-owned utilities, individually.
Okay, thank you, Madam Chair. It's helpful.
Good questions. Representative Kelly.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and really this isn't a question for Mr. Black, but since he referenced it a couple of times, I'd just like your experience, Madam Chair, or even Representative Beard, I would go to. We're going to have a lot of discussion about alternative energy and the mandate there. I'm just wondering if history here has a justification of why we don't count the hydropower above 100 megawatts towards that renewable energy source. I'm just curious because it's always intrigued me that we talk about all the time, but all of a sudden we have a cutoff.
Representative Kelly, I will let Mr. Eliff answer that question briefly, and then we're going to move on because we have to adjourn at 1:30.
Thank you, Madam Chair. It's always a little dicey to talk about legislative intent around here, but and I wasn't around here when that was originally passed, but my understand actually the original renewable energy objective, the cutoff was 60 megawatts and was increased later on. My guess is that the reason was because the legislature wanted the development of new sources, and it didn't make much of a point to count old sources toward the standard. If they counted old sources, they might have upped the percentage.
Representative Kelly.
No, thank you.
Okay. Any other quick questions for Mr. Black? If not, we'll go on to Minnesota Power. Representative Grafflo.
Madam Chair, I would just say that I know that the House DFL caucus is meeting with the governor at 1:30, so that's why you guys got to adjourn this meeting. But if there's some way we could work with the committee schedule to give testifiers a little bit more time over it. I know the Republican caucus is actually meeting with the governor after committee time. We moved it to that time, so maybe the DFL could consider not schedule. I mean, the governor does have quite a bit of free time, and we've had a lot of opportunity to pull you guys in on his, I don't know if I'll call it a budget, whatever it is, but maybe if that could just be worked into the committee schedule so that people are not rushed through a committee today, that would be appreciated.
Representative Grafflo, we did work that into the schedule, and we took about half of today's testifiers and shifted them to next week. So the folks who are here today have the exact amount of time they need for us to finish at 1:30. Mr. Black, thank you for your presentation, and I would appreciate if you'd keep in touch as we consider issues in this committee and help us understand how those issues affect people in your association. Representative Quam, did you have a very quick question?
Yes, Madam Chair. If we can get the data later on, with the munis, a lot of these small coal facilities, Rochester, et cetera, are going to be phasing out due to new rules from the PCA. If we can get an idea of what the capacity that you're losing in the near term, and then an idea of what the general trend you're moving for replacement power, you know, type, etc., and get that committee. Thank you.
That would be helpful.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Ms. Pierce, we have your slides on paper, but gathering that we don't have it in electronic format?
That is correct.
And what I'll just tell you is the microphones for the testifying table aren't that great. Okay. And so you want to just make sure it's aimed at you. And then go ahead and introduce yourself and please proceed.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair. Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Julie Pierce, and I'm a manager of the long-term strategy and planning area for Minnesota Power. I'm pleased to be here today and provide a brief overview of Minnesota Power, an electric utility with over 100 years of history in serving the electrical needs of Northeast and Central Minnesota. I will go through the handout that I provided as we move efficiently through this discussion, letting you know when to turn the page. Minnesota Power is a very unique utility, not only in our location and power supply, but the customers we serve. Minnesota Power has 12 very large industrial customers that dominate our energy consumption. As you will see in the few of the coming graphics, the competitiveness of our industrial customers is also an essential part of the economy in Northeast Minnesota. Moving to page two, as an electric utility with approximately 1,000 employees, 2,000 megawatts of generation, and approximately 9,000 miles of transmission and distribution lines, we have been very busy over the past 7 years, investing $900 million in key projects to significantly reduce emissions from our facilities and add valuable renewable energy to our customer power supply, and doing this while also maintaining some of the most competitive electrical rates in the industry and nation. Moving on to page three, and before we get into our power supply attributes, the handout identifies some of our largest industrial customers that we serve in our service territory. Taconite mining and processing, paper products and pipelines make up our core industries, and the new diversification and expansions are also on the horizon. It's a very exciting time for our region. These 12 customers also employ thousands of employees in northern Minnesota. Moving to page four, the customer mix I just described brings with it a unique revenue stream and power supply requirement for Minnesota Power. The typical U.S. utility shown on the left is very different than Minnesota Power's makeup, which is shown on the right. While the state is from 2008, it is also representative of our 2012 revenue streams. A good example of this unique distribution is that one of our largest industrial customers has an annual bill that is approximately the same size as our entire residential customer revenue. So very interesting dynamic. Our industrial customers are thirsty for energy, and they utilize it 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, which requires a strong base of efficient generation resources that can produce energy to meet those demands around the clock. On page five, we are also very low cost, as I mentioned earlier, both in Minnesota and nationally, which allows our customers to stay competitive in their aggressive and global markets, and ultimately supporting the new economic growth in our region. Moving to slide six provides a little bit of insight of a little bit of our history since 1965 and our energy consumption of our customers, and to the future, where we see considerable potential for growth. It also shows the historical volatility of some of our large industrial customers, as well as some of the potential growth we're seeing from 2010 to 2015, where we can expect 4% growth in our energy consumptions by our industrial customers, and then from a long-term standpoint, see a 0.9% growth. This is very unique in the industry right now. A lot of the national utilities are talking about demand destruction. We're talking about significant growth in our utility, which is very, again, very exciting.
Representative Beard.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Pierce, in looking at your projections here, I'm fascinated with the resale. I think we'd all like to give us a brief definition of what resale is and why you're expecting a jump in about now, 2013.
Sure, absolutely.
Ms. Pierce.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representatives, yes, absolutely. The wholesale or resale customer class are those customers that are municipals within our region that we provide power to through contracts. The large growth that you're seeing in right now in the 2013 and 14 time frame is largely due to the City of Nashwauk's expansion of its SR Steel customer.
Good.
And that's that growth you're seeing there.
Thank you for the enlightenment. Appreciate it.
So moving on to page seven, I'd like to spend a little bit of time talking about our generation power supply. Hopefully this graphic helps you visualize regionally where our power supply resides, as well as how we're leveraging some of the assets in our neighboring regions to provide a very cost-effective power supply for our customers. Largely, our fleet is in our service territory. We have been, for over 100 years, a large hydro utility. We have over 100 megawatts of hydro operations on the St. Louis River system. I think that makes us the largest hydro utility in the state of Minnesota. We also have 1,400 megawatts of efficient base load generation, and that is largely coal-fired in our region. We've built and procured this baseload generation throughout the years as our customers have also grown. Again, thirsty for that efficient, round-the-clock energy. We've been there to meet their electric needs. We also have 100 megawatts of cogeneration facilities. We've leveraged partnerships and relationships with our large industrial customers to make efficient use of biomass residuals as well as natural gas to serve some of the generation needs. Most recently, we've created and implemented in North Dakota a significant amount of wind energy. In 2012, we brought online our Bison 1 and 2 wind farms, making up over 200 megawatts of additional generation in North Dakota. We're able to bring that vast wind resource, an economical resource, to our customers in Northeast Minnesota through our strategic acquisition of a DC direct current transmission line that brings the wind power from North Dakota to Minnesota to our customers, also depicted on the graphic. In green, we have a lot of a few items that we are looking to for the future. First, we are phasing out of some of our coal-fired generation out in North Dakota that is originally from the Square Butte entity or the Milton R. Young Station. So by phasing out of over 200 megawatts of coal-fired generation, we are making room on that direct current transmission line to bring wind, the rest of our wind fleet, back to Northeast Minnesota, effectively removing coal by wire and making it wind by wire. We're also looking to Manitoba Hydro. We've recently received approval from the Regulatory Commission to purchase 250 megawatts of power, hydroelectric power, from the north starting in the 2020 timeframe. That'll help us meet some of that potential growth that we have been discussing. That transaction will be made possible by the implementation of a new transmission line. We are embarking on a project called the Great Northern Transmission Line that will build new high voltage transmission from Manitoba, Canada, to Northeast Minnesota. We also plan additional wind expansion in North Dakota, again taking advantage of federal tax credit extensions recently given, and embarking on a Bison 4 project. We're still under development of that project, but hopefully we'll be solidifying our project soon. So moving on to slide 8, Minnesota Power has really been reshaping its power supply with a resource strategy since 2005 that's incorporating more flexible, more diverse resources while reducing emissions overall in our system. Our plans are to have a more balanced power supply for the long term. As you can see in the graphic on page 8, we've already moved significantly with our implementation of hydroelectric, wind, and additional biomass in 2013. And as we look to the long term, you can see we're about a third coal generation, a third renewables, and a third market purchases in natural gas. That is our long-term vision. We'd like to reduce emissions, preserve reliability for our customers, and protect affordability overall for our Northeast Minnesota service territory. Slide 9 addresses our renewable mandate progress. We are ahead of the 2012 12% requirement through the proactive and prudent investment in the economic wind projects I described. We have been able to actually provide benefit to our customers by implementing these projects and are definitely on track to meet the 25% goal by 2025. Moving on to slide 10, while we've been reshaping our power supply portfolio to meet new needs with less emission intensive generation, we've also been taking care of our existing fleet. And through the proactive steps to reduce emissions and $355 million of investment since 2005, we've reduced emissions from our fleet by 70%, a significant feat in a short amount of time. We've also announced that we'll be implementing a large retrofit project on our Boswell Unit 4 station, our most efficient baseload generator, with an effective, cost-effective emission control to meet the state mercury requirement and recently finalized EPA requirements for mercury. Page 11 identifies our progress with greenhouse gases and CO2 reductions. As you can see, with our implementations of our additional renewable and our planned Manitoba purchase, we are reducing emissions of greenhouse gases by 20% by 2015 while increasing our customer supply requirements by 30%. So as our load goes up, we're filling it up and meeting that with less CO2 intensive resources and well positioned to meet our state greenhouse gas goals by 2050. Lastly, on page 12 and 13, I'll talk a little bit about our conservation programs. Minnesota Power has a long history in conservation programs and successfully implementing tools for our customers as they seek ways to reduce their usage. We have a very purpose-based strategy, calling the power of one, and we've been working with customers to identify energy-saving opportunities. The graphic on page 12 identifies for the past, since 2004, how we've been meeting or exceeding the 1.5% requirement in the state of Minnesota. And one of the ways we've also been helping customers is providing them tools. Slide 13 identifies a key tool that we provide for not only our customers, but for other utilities in the region looking for ways to reach out and work with their customers on determining what mechanisms of conservation they should employ. If a customer comes to us and indicates they have a dollar to spend on conservation, we'd like them to be able to assess where they're at in their energy saving goals, and then with information and discussion, assess where they will apply that dollar. And through tools like this, we're able to create very good relationships with our customers. And that is my presentation, Madam Chair.
Questions? Nobody has any questions for Ms. Pierce. It's a great presentation. If all of the testifiers who testified today who haven't sent their materials electronically would do that, then I'll distribute those to the members. Sometimes when we're debating a particular policy on the House floor, a member will remember a particular characteristic of one utility or another and want to look back at some information. And if we have that electronically, it's a lot easier to do it during the floor debate or during subsequent debates. So if we could have that. And then your contact information. So if members have more in-depth questions, it'd be more time-consuming that they can contact you directly by email or telephone. That'd be great. Well, members, that's all we have for today. Because today is Tuesday, we just have one meeting this week. We're going to do the minutes now. What we're going to do, I know you see in other committees, people just randomly do the minutes at the beginning, and they pick somebody and say, oh, I'm sure you've had time to read the minutes. We actually have assigned Representative Morgan as the vice chair to read the minutes. And at the end of every hearing, we're going to move the minutes because he will have had time to figure out if we made any mistakes. Representative Morgan, give a motion.
Madam Chair, I am honored to move the minutes of January 14 and adoption of those minutes.
We can do a roll call.
Do you want to Representative the Beard requests a roll call.
both of them?
Madam Chair, I understand I can actually move the both minutes at the same time. So that's not too fast for anybody. We'll move the minutes of January 15 and adoption of those minutes, please.
All those in favor?
Aye.
All those opposed? The motion prevails. The minutes are adopted. Representative Palm, you had a question.
No, I was going to point out if you do both.
Okay. Sounds good. Have a good week and see you next Monday. We're adjourned.